On today's episode,
The Bardo Part 2,
The Problematic Origins of Theosophy,
and a little clip of the Little Buddha.
Yeah. I would say I'm definitely most interested in the worthless areas.
Yeah.
Welcome to What's My Thesis. I'm Seth Lauer.
And I'm Javier Proenza. We're Los Angeles-based artists who meet every week to share the answers we found to the questions we have.
Join us as we explore and expand our worldviews through research and ask, what's my thesis?
What you got going on? Anything? Any near-death experiences?
Let's see. What health problems can I talk about?
Oh my God. I thought you didn't. There was one episode where you didn't want me to label you as someone who doesn't talk a lot, but you're happy to be a hypochondriac.
Man.
And how are those not compatible?
I had a dentist appointment that got rescheduled. Does that count?
All right. I'm going to come and check in with something a little bit more interesting than that. No, I think you're an excellent podcaster.
So anyway, you know, I do get a little, deflated, deflated. But it's my fault because I don't have any cool thing to say I did in the past week. Well, actually, I did go to Monterey. I went up to visit for Thanksgiving. I visited some family up there, which was really nice. And, you know, Central Coast is always refreshing. Get like, see some beaches that are not just swarmed by Coors chugging, you know, volleyball players.
Have you been going to like commercials when you go to the beach? That sounds amazing. I want to go to the course with the volleyball. Are they like all, you know, slender ladies bouncing around with jiggly parts?
We're in Los Angeles. Isn't that what is? I mean,
that sounds like everybody's people are hating you right now that aren't in Los Angeles listening to you talk about, dream. Was Spuds McKenzie there?
There's a dog on my street that is a Spuds dog, McKenzie Terrier or something like that. I just realized that I totally walked into another quote from the Bardo episode. That like the scene of the beautiful people on the beach, it's used as an example of how a lot of these, are we in the episode now? Should we wrap this before I get to that point?
Yeah, no, well, whatever. I mean, I'd like to make a beat. I like for us to have the ability to make little sound clips. So yeah, that's why I like the breaks.
Then I'll find my passage.
Yeah. Okay. And dude, you can make sound clips too, man. Do you make beats at all? I don't know.
Do you even make beats, bro?
Do you make beats? I know you lift.
I don't. I have in the past.
You have? But. Well, yeah. Well, I have in the past too. So I'm using this as an opportunity. But I didn't mean to just like dominate that turf. Make some music, bro.
Okay.
All right. So we'll take a break.
This is part two of the Bardo episode, the episode in which we actually get to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was the main focus of the podcast.
Yeah, and I do want to remind you that that book was written by a horned devil, a horned white devil. we assume.
Allegedly. Don't forget
allegedly. Allegedly, we assumed. So
we were talking a little about this beach scene, this mythical beach scene. This is one of the things that is mentioned by what's his name in the book of Living and Dying, where he says you don't have to be dead to experience these realms of the barter. You can just look around. You can see Wall Street people. They're like hungry ghosts, which is the thing in the Bardo. Mm-hmm. You can go to the beach in Los Angeles and it's like demigods. Mm-hmm. So he uses these as examples.
We're back to Evans.
This is still from Rinpoche, the Tibetan guy living in Britain who wrote the alternative book.
The one in response to
about living and dying. That's okay. In response.
Oh, yeah. The Tibetan book of the living and the dead.
So all he's doing is saying, like, so in the Bardo, there are these realms. There are gods, there are demigods, there are hungry ghosts.
What are we?
I kind of feel like a hungry ghost, but when I go to the beach, then I guess I'm a demigod.
So is it geography based?
No, they're, it's all about, like, what kind of, like, if you're a hungry ghost, that means you're always grasping and trying to get more. Mm-hmm. And so I think that could be manifested in a demon, but it could also just be who you can become if you're not careful.
In the post Bardo.
I think so.
And the afterlife Bardo.
The afterlife Bardo. Yep. One of the Bardos of the afterlife. So in the last episode, we kind of wrapped up talking about the not shitty Beatles.
Okay.
And there was another reference here. So the author of the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Actually, I remember the reference, but what are we talking about the not shitty Beatles in this context?
Well, because we wrapped the last one by saying that, you know, Lennon had pulled this quote from Leary's.
Oh, the actual Beatles. Not the shitty Beatles. Okay. He didn't say that Beatles are shitty. I just want to make sure we keep our boomer audience happy.
Okay, yeah. Just to talk about the least shitty of the Beatles, George Harrison.
Uh-huh. Was he the least shitty?
I don't know.
I guess I'm being puritanical by judging his...
I guess McCartney is probably the least shitty.
Yeah. As a human being?
As a human being, yeah.
Yeah. But musically, maybe Harrison was better as after the Beatles.
My Sweet Lord, the George Harrison song. I guess in the United States, he gave the proceeds from that song to this place, the Self-Realization Fellowship.
Is that like a cult kind of thing?
No. I think it's legitimately like a healing place of spiritual investigation where you can go. It's kind of, I think it has mixtures of Buddhist, Hindu, and Christian elements. Mm-hmm. But there's actually a few branches in LA. Like, you can go and just hang out. It's like a garden. It's a peaceful place. So, but this guy, Evans Wentz, actually, I want to say he died at the same place where Harrison hung out, at one of these Self-Realization Fellowships. Mm-hmm. You know, Harrison was there visiting Ravi Shankar when he was like learning to play sitar. Mm-hmm. Oh, and also interesting factoid, the Palisades location, Pacific Palisades in LA, speaking of the Mahatma, they have some of Gandhi's ashes apparently at that location. Yeah. So if you ever
drop acid, that's like the least creepy.
You can go there and, you know. This, by the way, have you heard anything about Tibetan forms of getting rid of dead bodies?
What are you talking about? I gotta get eight.
You gotta call the Tibetan.
I'm trying to think of some like koan that I can do in that accent. Yeah, I failed. You gotta transcend matter. Yeah, so
I'll bust you, Adams.
So go. These are all terrible. It's all getting chopped up.
So anyway, I don't know to what extent this still happens or ever happened. And I don't mean to judge it, because I think there is, you know, this is certainly, there's the potential for a judgy like thing, which I don't want to do.
Wait, did they become cannibals?
No, but okay. So like there's the belief that everything breaks down into the basic elements, fire, water, air. I feel like there's another one, but I'm forgetting. In how do you say it respectfully, not getting rid of bodies? Because it's not necessarily burial, right? It's
just
cremation is one form, because that would be going to fire. They might cremate you, or just
you I might. I think the problem you're having is getting rid. It what? Implies that they don't want him, and that's where the murder aspect comes in. I'm trying to help, but there it seems. How do they tend to the dead?
There you go.
That was a pretty.
Thank you.
Tend fucking to the nailed dead. That yeah, one. I'm that's happy. Exactly.
One of the things that is famous in Tibet is because there's not a lot of ground.
Uh huh.
There's not really like so many burials happening. Some might end up in rivers. Some might be chopped up and fed to birds.
I got no problem with that.
Okay. So
you get
vultures,
to shit on your monk friends?
There are people whose job it is to chop up corpses into small enough pieces that the birds can take them. So this is thought of as...
And they have PTSD.
Going back to the air.
I don't think you could just like, oh yeah...
I mean, I can't imagine how...
Well, maybe morticians don't get it, but they're not chopping bodies. It's not like fucking... This is the... You're not getting to that, like, this is the beef that I am.
The beef that I am?
Yeah, like, I you know, it would be like a cow chopping up another cow and having that realization of, like, I am dealing with my own flesh, with my own similar flesh.
Well, in this... And again, like, I'm no expert on... Buddhism at all, and so like I am definitely going to say something false in one of these episodes, so apologies about that. I'm not trying to be like mansplaining or, you know, the some expert based on 1 week of research, but
2 weeks
of research, to be fair. I am probably something of an authority after 2 weeks, but
a fortnight.
I read something about trying to just imagine the human body breaking down, the flesh of it. Imagine yourself being torn apart. Imagine yourself being eaten by animals. It's kind of like trying to prepare yourself for death by acknowledging and imagining the most abject, violent thing that you could consider to your body as a way of separating yourself from your body. So I think, you know, that seems to be somewhat present in some teachings. And so I think you must, if it's your job to cut up corpses to feed to vultures, you have to be like...
To get best at it.
You have to be good at that, yeah. Because how else do you not lose it, you know?
Yeah.
And they also, like, if there are any parts left... Apparently they would, like small parts, they would put them into dough or something and then feed those to the... So like the whole thing is very complete.
Yeah. But I mean, I know that they want to put the food in the air, but it's just going to end up on the ground again.
There's that, you know.
Or on, like I said earlier, which you just plowed right through, which I thought was a great joke. That they're gonna just because they're going to rain down onto the person that chopped them up into little pieces.
Wait, you said that earlier?
No, not so eloquently.
Okay.
And I wasn't upset.
Okay, so I've tempted people long enough. Here, I'm just gonna say Richard Gere is banned in China. Did you know that?
Is it because he's a Buddhist and they're anti-Tibet?
Yeah, so he's pro-Tibet. He's been...
Why are they tripping,
he's spoken out in favor of the Dalai Lama. And he actually says that his Hollywood career has been damaged because of that. Because investors, whatever, from China would say, we don't want this guy to be part of it. Oh, and there's also an audiobook read by Richard Gere.
A about of the
based on the the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Okay, like it's sort of like how which is Elon Musk. The reference I didn't, the thing I didn't talk about last episode.
You can just say him.
Father. Well, to some degree, I think it's funny that he's saying that we live there's a chance that we live in a simulation. I'm like, of course of course you think that you have like a fucking awesome life, but what about the people that don't have that amazing life? Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like that. Like if you're already super talented and successful and you're into this stuff, you might believe it because it sort of works for you, or because you're just like on this crazy momentum that's separate from it. But mm-hmm. it's just a way of rationalizing what's happening to you, like a belief system.
Okay.
You're mad that I brought him up.
When will it end?
You know it's not going to end.
I'm going to find some dirt on him.
I just think that he is a fucking great archetype.
Did I tell you or everyone in our listening audience that Wingle...
Hi, Mom.
Wingle recently saw a Tesla with a license plate that was, it's Elon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, you didn't. How dare you not tell me this? This is like...
She has a photo of it.
He's real.
Do you think that's him? Or do you think it's...
Someone that's just...
Someone clever. That's just like everyone. Everyone is Elon.
Well, I told you to remind me, but I guess since you don't want him on the show, you didn't. But I sent you a picture of a billboard that said, because Elon hasn't figured out healthcare or something like that, healthcare yet, saying that like you should go with this company. So it's not just me, man. It's just this idea. He's bigger than a human being in people's minds.
Yeah, I don't think that'll last.
Oh no, he's a fucking human. But it's sort of like we found our new Steve Jobs, and we're craving for it. But he messed up when like someone, there was articles written about when someone got hit like into a car accident with the self-driving Tesla. His like reaction was really poor. Yeah. He's not invulnerable. I just love this billionaire like waxing philosophical about life.
Mm-hmm. Leonard Cohen, just to finish that thought, he does this great interview with him on Fresh Air.
Uh-huh.
Have you heard it?
No. He's still alive?
No. Okay. He died like maybe a year ago.
Oh, but it was more recent than I thought.
Yeah. I really mourn it. Like I love Leonard Cohen and Bowie both. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had like a serious phase of both. He had this funny quote where he referred to the hustle and bustle of show business life as being like Boogie Street.
Mm-hmm.
And so Terry Gross asked him why he went to the monastery. And apparently he was actually a personal assistant for a monk there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was there for like a good amount of time.
And personal assistant to a monk? That sounds unmonkly from the monk standpoint.
It sounds a little iffy, right? Yeah. Like, but then I guess part of it is probably like, I mean, you have to work. You're there. You're not going to be like just having monks put grapes in your mouth or something, right?
You could have Leonard Cohen feed you grapes. I'm sure many people have had grapes by his hand.
But she asked him why he left the monastery, and he said that the monastery was Boogie Street too.
Uh-huh.
It's not as funny the way I say it, but it's, you know, it's interesting because it's possible for me to kind of romanticize going to a monastery and like having some sort of ascetic.
I thought you were going back to the penny rain aspect. I'm like, you're into that? I didn't know you like nuns.
I mean, I'm into grapes. I do like grapes.
Oh. If
whoever wants to put a grape in my mouth, I'll take it.
Well, Leonard will hook you up, apparently.
As long as we're on this long meandering path. Again, still procrastinating, not getting to the actual book that I was going to talk about. Uh-huh. I might as well say that the Tim Robbins film, Jacob's Ladder, do you know this one?
Yeah.
It was based also on this book.
Spoiler alert. He was dead the whole time. We can cut it off.
You fucker.
No, I think it's known. I think it's a known thing.
And another reference to pop culture. Do you see the movie Enter the Void?
No.
The Gaspar Noé film? Did you see his more recent one, Love?
No.
Okay, well, the Love is basically just porn.
All right.
But there is a scene also in Enter the Void where...
Is it like just the porn or is it art porn?
Oh, no. I mean, it's he's trying to be artful. Love is not very critically well-received, but I think generally Enter the Void was. There's a scene in Enter the Void. Well, I have a description here if you want. I can just read it.
Hold on. Let me take my pants off.
Got any grapes over there? Each couple emanates a pulsating, electric-like pink glow from their genitals. Oscar enters Alex's head and witnesses the sex with Linda from Alex's point of view. He then travels inside Linda's vagina to witness Alex's thrusting, then observes his ejaculation and follows the semen into the fertilization of his sister's ovum.
Okay. Even before you got the sister.
You were with this, it up until
this,
that point?
No, or? Even before you got to sister, this is like the least sexy experience, way to experience sex is to like teleport and see all these like angles of like, yeah. I don't want to see, I don't need to know what the inside of a vagina looks like.
Yeah,
I mean, not from being trapped inside of it. I'm sure it helps knowing my way around somewhat. I don't know. The ladies have all been very polite.
I'm going to break it down really briefly here. We already touched on the main Bardos. Here's a little more of Evans Wentz's depiction of each Bardo. Okay. The first Bardo, the Chikai Bardo, most people don't know they're dead for the first 3 to 4 days. This is where the clear light dawns. Each day, a different colored light shines, possibly even variations of lights, and you have to really watch it that you're not attracted to the wrong light. Like if you're attracted to a strong light, it's, I think the strong light is good, but the dull light is bad. Okay.
I feel really bad because I'm sure that a listener is right on board, but I've missed the gap from sister to where we are now.
You're still trying to picture that ejaculation scene. So, I know which Bardo you're gonna get stuck in, but do you know that what happens when you find your birth mother and father
in a Bardo?
You witness them having sex.
Oh, God. That would be really awkward for everybody, especially because they're not together anymore. I wonder if that matters. We don't love each other, but it's a Bardo.
No, wait. Just to clarify, this is not your previous mother and father. This is your next mother and father of your next life.
I could get down with that.
Yeah?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, they're young, presumably.
Presumably, yeah. And so there's this other interesting Freudian thing happening where you'll know you're going to be a boy or a girl based on your feelings about your parents. So if you're very attracted to your mother and very jealous of your father, you're going to be a boy.
All right.
So I'm not quite sure, like, that seems pre-Freud.
So, yeah. No, it does.
You know, it just goes to show how much
people want to fuck their mothers.
Okay, I was going to go a different direction with that.
Sorry, I don't want to fuck my mother. Go ahead. That's obviously a bit. I don't want to fuck my mother, Seth. Oh, God, sorry.
I didn't say you did.
This is not going to go in the theme song.
Oh man, I think we found our clip. Okay, so you know how Carl Jung was all about, you know, the collective, what is it, collective unconscious, universal consciousness kind of thing. That to me is not dissimilar from what this kind of theosophist Evans Wentz perspective is, where you're trying to tap into some original source or commonality to a lot of these myths. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it almost like implies that when you hear that about the Oedipal thing being pre-Freud, you're kind of like, well, yeah, where does that come from? Is there some, I don't want to get into it, but
is there some truth to that?
Is there some truth? But I'll say also, Jung wrote, by the way, I think it was like the intro or the foreword to the original edition of Evans and Wentz's Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Oh man.
And that's just fraught with problems too, as you can imagine.
Yeah, Jung is kind of fraught with problems.
He's fraught, yeah.
He's fraught. That's a t-shirt. He's fraught.
getting back to the first bardo. For example, on the fourth day, the color is red for fire. And there are different Buddhas. The particular Buddha appearing there appears in red on a peacock throne with a lotus in his hand. On the fifth day, the color is green for air with a green Buddha. Dazzlingly green, transparent and radiant, glorious and terrifying, beautified with orbs surrounded by satellite orbs of radiance issuing from the heart of the divine mother father. Second bardo, I think it's pronounced Chosniad, realizing reality, thoughts become hallucinations. So what the dead person has thought and done, they become objective. This is called the consciousness content of the dead one's personality. So for a while, he believes he still has a body. He might go visit that body. He might go visit his dead ones, and he'll be really confused at why they're not reacting to him and why he can't get into this body. The realization only comes if you see you don't have a shadow or you see into a mirror. But this kind of feeling can eventually lead to desperation to get into any body you can find. And that's where you can kind of be led to a dangerous reincarnation situation. Mm-hmm. On the seventh day, the very colored radiance of the purified propensities will come to shine, surrounded by peaceful deities. Okay, so days 1 through 7, you may encounter a peaceful deity. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, it gets intense. Okay.
Is it a different deity? Or does he just get grouchy?
They actually apparently are the same deities that become wrathful.
Okay.
And
one, then what triggers that?
It's all part of this. I don't want to say it's like a test, but to me it feels that way, where if you can kind of like realize that the horror show happening in front of you is more or less an illusion. Mm-hmm. You can then transcend. You can attain Buddhahood if you're able to see through it and stay calm and collected. But you might freak out. You might fall over a precipice and essentially land in a bad reincarnation. So there are 58 flame-inhaloed, wrathful, blood-drinking deities who are, as I said, peaceful deities in changed aspect. I will now read an excerpt. The eighth day. And this also, I think, gives you a sense of how these things are structured and the kinds of things that the reader will be saying to the deceased. Or the dying, right? Or this could even just be read throughout life. But assuming that this is a dead person, dead or dying. Again, calling the deceased by name, address him thus. This is written, some of it, in a kind of a stuffy, older English style, you know, because 20s, I mean. Mm-hmm. Oh, nobly born, listen undistractedly. Not having been able to recognize when the peaceful deities shone upon thee in the bardo above, thou hast come wandering thus far. So we're assuming that in the previous 7 days, the deceased did not manage to move on. Now, on the eighth day, the blood-drinking, wrathful deities will come to shine. Act so as to recognize them without being distracted. O nobly born, the great glorious Buddha Hiruka, dark brown of color, with three heads, six hands, and 4 feet firmly postured, the right face being white, the left red, the central dark brown, the body emitting flames of radiance, the 9 eyes widely opened in terrifying gaze, the eyebrows quivering like lightning, the protruding teeth glistening and set over one another, giving vent to sonorous utterances of ah-la-la and ha-ha and piercing whistling sounds. The hair of a reddish-yellow color standing on end and emitting radiance, the heads adorned with dried human skulls and the symbols of the sun and moon, black serpents and raw human heads forming a garland for the body, the first of the right hands holding a wheel, the middle one a sword, the last one a battle axe, the first of the left hands a bell, the middle one a skull bowl, the last one a plowshare, His body embraced by the mother, Buddha Krotisharima.
Can I say something real quick? That dude needs all those hands. Because he just doesn't have a free hand. Like, even with that many hands, he still doesn't have a single free hand.
I know. But yeah. Can you imagine if he had more hands? How terrifying?
I don't know that would fix his problems. I think he's got an issue with carrying things in his hands.
This is essentially a human deity problem, right? Because if our feet could grasp tools, then we'd be in... Sorry, I don't mean to make light of this. This is a religious text, you know, I don't want to fuck with people's stuff. But kind of too late.
I do.
Let me just point out, I brought up Richard Gere and Keanu Reeves and Timothy Leary. Uh-huh. So if we feel the need to laugh, we can laugh at them and not at the Bardo total.
I'm not laughing at the guy. I'm just making an observation that dude has a lot of stuff in his hands.
He does. Yep.
You're the one that got all nasty. I don't even know what you said.
He does need a tote bag. That would help.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't think more hands would help. I think storage space, portable like backpack kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine how many straps that backpack would have, though. A pull cart. But then he could get into like a situation where he just has too many pull carts. Ugh. He needs something he can put on his shoulder. Cycle. Yeah.
Stuff maintenance. It's just, you know.
What are the... So he has a bunch of stuff. Do you, like... Having read it a few times, do you know... Is there a theme? Like, in the items? There's a share plow. There's what else?
Oh, you're going to make me read that again. I don't know.
That you made that connection.
I don't know why.
You don't know why?
They're important symbolic things.
Okay.
The wheel is like a general important Buddhist symbol.
Okay.
But... My interest in this is how incredibly gory and violent it's about to get.
All right.
Okay. So...
How many of those things were weapons?
A battle axe is a weapon.
Yeah.
A sword is a weapon. A bell is probably not a weapon.
It's just to scare motherfuckers.
I mean, I would be pretty scared if this guy was shaking a bell at me.
Yeah. It's not the bell by itself. It's the fact that he's got the other stuff.
It's the 11 the bell, hands yeah. holding other things.
He's got one hand extra just for a bell. So that you know he's coming. Never mind.
Well, you know what happens when a bell rings?
What? An angel gets its wings?
No, don't be ridiculous. Somebody gets his head chopped off by a fucking wrathful deity.
Oh, so it's like a ding, order up.
Okay, so her right hand is clinging to his neck and her left putting to his mouth a red shell filled with blood, making a palatal sound like a crackling and a clashing sound and a rumbling sound as loud as thunder, emanating from the two deities, radiant flames of wisdom blazing from every hair pore of the body and each containing a flaming dorje. Don't know what that is. The two deities together thus, standing with one leg bent, and the other straight and tense on a dais supported by horned eagles. Horned eagles.
Evans.
Called that one. Will come forth from...
You're the one who called it.
I'll take credit when credit's due. although I have read this before, so... Know it to be the embodiment of thine own intellect.
The horns are?
Yeah, if you want to see horns, there's going to be horns. As it is thine own tutelary deity, be not terrified. Be not afraid, for in reality it is the Bhagavan Virochana, the father mother. Simultaneously with the recognition, liberation will be obtained, if they be recognized, merging thyself in at one mint into the tutelary deity, Buddhahood. Okay, will be one. You see where that's going? Mm-hmm. So one other little violent section, if I may be permitted to...
Be violent, yeah.
Is this interesting? I feel like this would get the kiddos on board. They're like into violent things.
I don't know. I like swords. I like multiple hands. Okay. Yeah, kids like how young of an audience are we going for?
So from the south, this is day 9. Things kind of escalate a little bit. Mm-hmm. The yellow Tsurima holding a bow and arrow ready to shoot from the west. The red Pramoha holding a Makara banner from the north. The black Pitali holding a Dorje again. And a
people have been into Game of Thrones shit forever. It's not a new phenomenon. Go ahead.
You're saying this is a derivative of Game of Thrones?
Game of Thrones, yes. This is derivative of Game of Thrones.
Holding...
Well, I guess the flags are probably more like in Ran.
Oh, uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. What's his name?
Kurosawa movie.
Yeah. What I just wanted to say is...
It would be interesting if I figured out through this podcast that I'm wildly racist and inappropriate all the time.
Yeah. That would be interesting.
That knowing pause was like...
Blood-filled skull bowl. There's so many skulls full of blood. Okay, and drinking from them.
It's convenient.
Yeah.
It's container-like.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
I mean, it has a huge bunch of holes at the bottom, but I wonder how you seal those up.
Tom Waits, I feel, must be really into this book.
Really? Why?
He's all about drinking blood from skulls.
Is that, like, lyrically?
I remember at least one song where he talks
about it.
Yeah. Okay, let me just move through this. The right stirring it with a Dorje. What the hell is a Dorje? You gotta help me. Can you Google that?
Making me work.
D-O-R-J-E. And she then, drinking it with majestic relish from the northwest, the yellowish-white sandali tearing asunder a head from a corpse, the right hand holding a heart, the left putting the corpse to the mouth, and she then eating thereof. From the northeast, the dark blue smasha. How great is that name, smasha? Tearing asunder a head from a corpse and eating thereof. These, the 8 karimas of the abodes of 8 directions, also come to shine upon thee, surrounding the 5 blood-drinking fathers.
I have no idea what a Dorje is.
It didn't come up?
It's not a thing. it didn't come up.
There's also a judgment period, at least in some accounts, that the original text, there are some variations. So the one, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Evans-Wentz version, is based on one particular version. Mm-hmm. Okay, and different groups or communities, they might have slight variations. It would basically be the same. But, you know, these are all handwritten physical things.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is all pre-printing press then.
Yeah. Slightly. There's also a judgment period similar to that in Plato's Republic, where it suggested the dead meditate upon the thought of the good genius, also called the little white god, who is essentially...
Elon Musk.
Essentially the best highest self, who was born simultaneously with him to count his good deeds, represented by white pebbles. But there's also the evil genius, also born simultaneously... who personifies his carnal or lower nature, who counts bad deeds on black pebbles.
Jimmy Wills.
Okay, and at this point things get kind of intense. Consulting the mirror of karma, the lord of death will place round thy neck a rope and drag thee along. He will cut off thy head, extract thy heart, pull out thy intestines, lick up thy brain, drink thy blood, eat thy flesh, and gnaw thy bones. But... thou will be incapable of dying. The repeated hacking will cause intense pain and torture. Okay, the geniuses then continue counting the pebbles, at some point a decision is reached based on your karma, I guess.
I wonder if, like, it, you know, if sci-fi was a bigger genre in the times of, like, this book and the Bible, like, if like, people had just put their creative output into those things instead, because this is all so, like, and even the Bible, it's all very, it's obviously fire and brimstone, but it's like, super imaginative, mm-hmm. based on, no, like, I mean, how the fuck do they know? I'm sorry, I know it's a religious text, but, like, I am not picking on this religion in particular. I'm talking about a religion general, in general. Like
Genesis scenarios.
These are all so, and obviously to some degree, I mean, I don't know how literally people take these texts in this, mm-hmm. especially in this case, but it really is, like, going back to that Game of Thrones thing. It's just, it's so, first of all, it's depraved. Like, you know, these are people writing religious texts and they're talking about, like, eating flesh and all of this shit. Like, it seems an interesting thing to, like, I wonder if you can really get back to the kind of people that wrote these texts. And then it's also fun when you were saying that. I like the idea of somebody that's transcribing, you know, like a scribe or a monk that's, like, copying a text and he's like, I don't like how you worded that, and just, like, edits it.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm sure that happened.
Well, yeah. I mean, probably, you know, it's very sincere. Like, everyone is always if they're making changes or adjustments, I'm sure it's directed more to be accurate according to, you know,
the discipline.
Yeah. Any questions at this point?
Why are these guys so into violence? Is there a need for there to be something visceral for you to be afraid? Is this, like, kind of how Catholicism is very fear-based? Is that the symbol? Because, I mean, Tibet, this is Buddhism, right?
Yeah.
So it seems very counter to, most of their living stuff isn't this violent, right?
No. I mean, yeah, on the contrary, the teachings, you know, I mean, often vegetarian diet is practiced, although in Tibet, I think less because there's not as many plants.
So where does someone writing this text get that inspiration to just be so, like, graphic? Like, it's the same thing. It's like writing a novel.
I think part of it, this is my interpretation. Like earlier I was saying, I think part of it is coming to terms with mortality and the physical uh-huh. nature of living and dying.
But the torture aspect is what I'm like, and it is in a lot of books, right? And just hearing it in this context in a religion that I don't know that much about, but have made assumptions about, to me it's interesting that is just the place that people go to when they're writing the religious text.
Yeah. Well,
and I don't expect you to have the answer, but I just find that interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So I think
I wonder if Scientology has, like, people getting, I mean, because the whole you know, Jesus getting put up on a cross is really graphic and violent. So obviously this is a much more violent society than blunt instrument violent.
Well, you know, at the time, I mean, we're talking, like, around the first century. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Buddhism, it may have even come earlier, mm-hmm. but, that was a violent time, like a lot of political takeovers just in the world.
I just don't know the region that well.
And remember that Buddhism didn't start in Tibet. It came, I think it came through Nepal.
Okay.
So
I didn't know that. Seth, so polite.
So you have India, you have China. It at some point it travels all through Nepal. Asia, and then you get compartmentalized. So certain schools of Buddhism, which might be more traditional, were in isolated places where there was less takeover.
They become localized and, yeah, and then react it to their life experience.
So what I'm going to say is I think the violence is, it's a response to not physical, literal violence, but it's attempting to prepare for mental disturbance and nightmares.
In this case,
which which, I mean, you can draw that parallel between dreams and the Bardo. Nightmares are another aspect of that.
Yeah.
And so again, the emphasis is always,
have you ever had dreams as violent as those descriptions? I don't think I have. Where I think I would be so scared right away that I would wake right up.
Yeah, well, yeah, normally it's not that graphic, but...
So there's maybe there's like some PTSD going into these. Like, I can't even begin to imagine some of these demonic things. But there are people that like horror and stuff like that. It just seems like a very, very... Like, I'm just trying to process it because, all right, that makes sense that in this context, like, maybe... The religion itself is a reaction to transcending the terrible violence or the terrible troubles of society. And so the assumption is that there are similar dangers when you're reborn. And remember, I am an expert on all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of don't even want to speculate really, but I think the main thing that I would highlight is that you always come back to this point of like, if you're seeing demons, if you're seeing some kind of horrific thing, it's a projection of your inner anxieties and fears.
You know, the people that would see this are the ones... Well, now I'm worried about the guy that wrote the book.
I don't know. And also, to be fair, like, I chose a couple of the most like juiciest extreme passages to read. So most of it's not really
not like that.
But, and also, I didn't read about the peaceful deities. I mean, you know, there's a lot of just like light, and a lot of it just focuses on colors of light. And then it's only if you, for whatever reason...
Are there cuddly deities?
You can't find...
Snuggly ones that just like kiss you. Like, come on, pick a nut, pick a reincarnation. Smoochy, smoochy, smooch. And then there are people that are like... I expect demons. I reject this. Is that sort of what it is?
I don't know.
Come on, Seth. Offend people. If you only hit these demons at a certain period, correct? Mm-hmm. In the, like on day whatever you come across as this demon or this variation of the demon, right? So my question, I think, is since the teachings are about how if you go into this bardo, you will essentially create your own reality through your own perception.
Yeah.
So is this an element where the people that have that end up staying longer because of the way that they react to the earlier deities?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, right. That's why if you go into it with less baggage, if you go into it with...
You're in and out.
A stronger mind that can kind of like accept and let go, then yeah, you might move very quickly or you may even skip the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's a lot of these strong images, they're directed to...
Get your stuff right now.
Living people to get ready and, you know, to
so
like...
So you don't have to spend too much time there.
To meditate and like strengthen your... perception in your mind so that just, you know, you can live better. And, you know, also there's so much anxiety with dying of what's next. Like, I suppose you could imagine some pretty terrifying scenarios and to be prepared for that and to trust that all you have to do is just wait it out. You know, that could bring some hope and relief to people. But yeah, I mean, it is, some of it is a very violent vision.
Yeah.
Apparently, there are some schools of Buddhism that don't believe in this bardo. Even if there's reincarnation, it moves immediately into that. And I, from what I've read, those tend to be the more traditional schools that they... The bardo total, this is a post-Buddha thing, right? Mm. So not all groups are okay with bringing in things that are post-Buddha. They try to stick with just the original teachings of Buddha. Yeah, let me just read a sample of what we mentioned in the previous episode. So this is Madame Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine, which, again, was sort of the basis for Evans Wentz's approach to...
Yeah, this is the one that's questionably racist about humans being superior to each other.
Yes, a very different theory of rebirth put forward here. Oh, and this is, by the way, just quoted from the foreword of the Tibetan Book of the Dead by Donald S. Lopez Jr. Okay. Claiming to be commenting upon the ancient Book of Dzogchen, written in the secret language of Senzar, she describes a system of 7 rounds. The earth has passed through 3 rounds during which it has evolved from a spiritual form to its current material form. The earth is currently in the 4th round. Over the final 3 rounds, it will slowly return to its spiritual form. The universe is populated by individual souls or monads, themselves ultimately identical with the universal oversoul, as asserted also in Vedanta. These monads are reincarnated according to the law of karma. During the present 4th round, these monads inhabit the earth in the form of 7 races. The first was a race of spiritual essences called the self-born, who had no physical form, inhabiting the imperishable sacred land until it sank into the ocean. The second race, called the Hyperboreans, lived at the North Pole. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
They also lacked physical form. The third root race, the Lemurians, were the first humans but lacked the senses of taste and smell.
They weren't part lemur?
I mean, with that name, you have to think. Their homeland, the vast continent of Lemuria, was destroyed by fire. Australia and Easter Island are its remnants. The fourth root race were the inhabitants of the continent of Atlantis. Maybe you've heard of it?
Mm-hmm.
An advanced race...
That's where Aquaman's from. It's a dope spot.
...that used electricity and flew in airplanes. Their civilization ended in the Great Flood. The last sub-race of Atlanteans was absorbed into the early sub-races of the fifth root race, the Aryans.
Ooh.
These early sub-races...
Classic favorite.
...included the Greeks, Egyptians, and Phoenicians. These Aryans later defeated other remnants of the Atlanteans, quote, yellow and red, brown and black, and drove them into Africa and Asia.
So I'm part Atlantean.
Could be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a little teaser of
the book.
What might be an eventual episode just on Theosophy.
Theosophy.
But this...
Is she the queen bee of Theosophy?
It kind of seems like it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this book was really the beginning, I think, of a lot of the important stuff.
Wow.
So she basically... I think her main thing was saying that tribal types or, quote, primitives are less evolved, essentially, in that they're not as capable of European minds of, like, you know... You know where I'm going. I don't have to...
No. Wait, please go on.
You're familiar with this concept. Okay.
What, people don't like other people?
Yeah, apparently so.
That are different from them. Okay.
So that's...
I thought you were going to say... it's not that the tribal people are worse than us. It's just that we're better.
In summation, that's the bardo. Seems like an interesting place to hang out. There's a lot happening. if you ever go there...
Celebrity sightings.
Good luck to you.
Yeah. Try to get out there quick. There's some bad stuff.
Don't look at the
what happens on the 49th day?
Oh, there's a party.
Do you get it, like, evicted but with pitchforks?
You know, I'm really not sure.
Oh, we're going to have a third episode all on the 49th day.
It does walk through all the days, but I don't know. After the 40th day, it's just like...
Hey guys, if you had fun, feel like you learned something, rate us, review us on iTunes, that helps us. And if you want to subscribe, that's actually very nice too. I'm at Javier Proenza on Instagram, and Seth is?
I'm at Seth Lauer on Instagram.
On Instagram.